Yes. Good afternoon. Bon appétit. Thanks for the invitation to talk here. As we are talking right now, my brothers, friends, and people are defending against a cruel enemy and who is, for the most part, unwilling to accept any peaceful compromise. So you may justly ask me, what am I doing here? And the answer is somewhat strange. It's on the first transparency. Okay, so I'm going to talk about conformal deformations of ABS 5 process 5, and this is work with Ofer Aharoni and Shimon Yankelevich.
And what does this have to do with the boys?
I don't know. That's my point. I really don't know what relevance it has. So at first I'll tell you the description of the problem, and later I will try to convince you why it's interesting. So ABS 5 crosses 5 solves the equation of motion of classical type 2B supergravity, of course, and has the following properties. It has 32 Keeling spinners, and it has the following isometries, bosonic isometries, SO4,2 for the ABS, and SO6 for the S5. Now, I'd like to deform it, but keeping some properties. I'd like to deform the solution, keeping the minimal amount of supersymmetry, and more importantly, keeping the ADS isometries, the SO4,2. So in sense, I'll be touching only the S5, not the ADS. So it will be deformed, but round in the sense that it still solves the equations of motion, actually the supersymmetry equations. Let's be a little more explicit. What are the equations here? The equations I want to solve are the supersymmetry variation equations of type 2B. So here I have the gravitino, and here I have the dilatino. Dm is the covariant derivative. G is the three-form field strength, which is made out of the NS and the Ramon-Ramon fields. F is the five-form field strength. Epsilon is the supersymmetry variation parameter, which in supergravity is space-dependent. Q is some function of B, where B is the complex scalar of type 2B, so it's closely related to the ordinary tau. It's a mapping of tau is defined in the upper half plane, and B is defined in the unit disk. So it's just the dilaton and the axion. And Pm is essentially the derivative of B. And our ansatz, as I said, I want to preserve the ABS form. So the most general metric that I can have is the original ABS, perhaps with some warp factor that depends on the sphere, some deformed sphere. There is only so much I can do to the phi form. I will discuss it later because of its constraints. There is only one parameter that can come in. The three form can be arbitrary as long as it has all its legs along the S5. And the B scalar, again, can depend on the X coordinate on the S5, but not on other coordinates. So that's the problem. I want to find how many deformations there exists, and to say something about these deformations, what is the geometry, and we'll see later more precisely what can we say about them. Okay, so the outline. First, description of the problem. Already had a check mark on that. Second, introduction and motivation. Then I'll go on. As you'll see, this has, as always in ADS-CFT, we have here a field theory side and a supergravity side. So I will start with the field theory side, which will not be my main focus. And then I will go on to the supergravity, first describing the general theory of nonlinear deformations, and then discussing in detail, that part will be more for the experts, our calculations, the ansatz, the equations, the perturbations, first and second order solution, and the important notion that I will explain, so in the obstruction. And I will conclude with a summary and open questions. Important warning, this is unpublished yet. While there is an agreement within the collaboration on the computation, there is no consensus yet regarding the interpretation, although we are close to that. There should be a double O there. Of course, only I am responsible for the interpretation presented here. Okay, so if there are questions later, we can discuss that. The central references that I'm going to discuss The paper by Schwartz, where he found the equations of motion and the supersymmetry variation of back-to-B supergravity back in 83. Very nice. The paper by Kim Romans and Van Nieuwenhuizen, where they found the spectrum of type 2B on ABS 5 process 5. A more recent paper by Grani and Kulczynski discussing the effect on supergravity to first order of a general deformation of the field theory, not necessarily conformal as I will be discussing, but any supersymmetric change in the field theory. And on the field theory side, I will need the paper by Lee and Strasser about exactly marginal operators in four dimensions. And as always, please ask questions during the talk. Okay, so introduction and motivation. So the starting point for us was that n equals 4 in four dimensions is known to have some exactly marginal deformations. Now, in non-supersymmetric theories, that's very difficult to find. But in supersymmetric theories, we have examples, and I will review in a moment how that works. So from the time that we knew about ABS-CFT, we could have asked, what does that mean on the supergravity side? So this question could have been asked for a long time, and actually, we've already been working on that for a long time, but many others have been working on it, and this problem proved difficult, but I think we now understand the main points. So I have here perhaps a partial list of people who attacked some sides of this problem. So, because it is there, that's one motivation. Oops. Now, what are the main questions? As we will see, from the field theory point of view, there is a question of a survival mechanism. We know that some deformations are marginal, but the question is which ones are exactly marginal and why are they marginal to all orders in the perturbation? And the question is, what does that map to into supergravity? That wasn't clear to us in the beginning, so I'll try to answer that question. The second question that I'll try to answer is, what are the constraints or the obstruction? Again, some of the marginal deformations are killed by some constraints while others survive. So I want to explain exactly what is this obstruction mode in the supergravity. This is actually an interesting case for the ABS-CFT dictionary. Almost exclusively, we've been using it to learn about strongly coupled gauge theory from supergravity. Here, we're going to start from the other way around. The field theory was available beforehand. So the field theory result about the exact marginal deformations was already available. We're going to use that to look into the gravity. However, the dictionary is not well enough to tell us the answer immediately, as I'll discuss, and it will turn out that once we understand the answer in supergravity, it actually clarifies or makes more precise the field theory statement. So I will want to claim that the field theory statement was not precise enough, and that was the reason that caused us problems in finding how it looks like on the supergravity. So that's also this point. And then what will we gain once we finish that? Well, we could go on to other ABS spaces. For instance, ABS 4 cross S7 could be analyzed very much the same way, and that's in progress. And there, the field theory dual is much less understood, much more poorly understood. But I'll show that we can certainly know something about its manifold of exactly conformal deformations, even though we know so little. A few more words of introduction. I would like to stress here the notion of the moduli space of conformal theories given a theory, which I call a calligraphic M sub C. We're very used to the fact that supersymmetric theories have a moduli space of vacua. So, but for a conformal theory, it's as natural to ask what is the conformal, the moduli space of conformal theories, what deformations I can make of the theory and still remain exactly conformal. For some reason, although in the last, I don't know, 7 or more years, we learned to get a lot of results on the moduli space of vacua, I think we know very little about M sub C. And I would like to ask some questions and address some of them over here, but most of them will remain unanswered. So this is more of a problem for the future. So the first question, which I will address here, is how do we know what is the dimension of MC? A very simple question. Second question is, what is the geometry of MC? Is it Kähler? Is it hyperKähler? So how does the geometry look like locally? Does it have any singularities? So in our case, it will have singularities. Is there any global topology? Is it compact, non-compact? As far as I can tell you, we don't know all these very simple questions. Once we understand that, we will be able to think about renormalization flow, not just a flow from a point going down in different directions, but we could start the flow from any point on MC and flow. So we could imagine a whole river rather than a unique stream flowing. And 4D equals 4, incidentally, has both. It has both M and MC. So the moduli space of Accia is very known and very simple, simply R to the power 6N divided by the permutation group, and we're going to discuss M sub C.
Excuse me,
can
you tell me why?
Yes.
Because I don't get
it. You don't get it?
Yeah.
Maybe it's wrong.
Am I wrong?
Let's see. Maybe I turned it incorrectly. It's the same. Okay. Is it okay now?
I'm going to check it out.
Ah, okay. Okay, so now I want to review the arguments of Lie and Strasser. How do we know about that there are actually two complex, exactly marginal deformations for this theory? So let's first review. N equals 4 has one complex, exactly marginal parameter, which is the complex coupling tau, which is related to the axion and the coupling like so, and which is the gauge group to be SUN. The global symmetry is SO6, the R symmetry. But once we go to n equals 1 language, the only manifest part will be SU3 cross U1R. There are marginal deformations, which I list over here. And actually, in order to understand them better, we should consider this plot from King Romans and Van Nieuwenhuis. And this is the spectrum. This axis is the mass. This axis is not important. You see here that at zero mass, there are three branches that intersect. This is the F squared that I mentioned. This is the 45 in the psi phi. And this is the 5 to the 4th. So these are the four modes that I'll be interested in that are candidates for first order deformation. Incidentally, these circle modes are the ones which are retaining gauge supergravity. So you see that this problem cannot be analyzed within gauge supergravity because it just doesn't keep these nodes. Okay, let's return. Yes. Ah, okay. These would give us marginal deformations, but not all of them are supersymmetric. Which ones are supersymmetric? To see that, we rewrite n equals 4 in an n equals 1 language, and then we have a vector multiplet and three chiral multiplets, all in the adjoint, and there's a superpotential. The superpotential is cubic in the phis, and it's contracted with the anti-symmetric, the constants of the gauge group, FABC, and IJK run from 1 to 3. To that, we can add now another term, a symmetric term, with D, where D is the symmetric trace that exists in SUN, and we may also change the value of this coefficient, W naught. So we have here HIJK, which will be very important for us, is a third rank symmetric tensor of SU3, so there are 10 complex such. There's also this H0, H naught, which is a single quantity. Okay, so that's the deformation in field theory. That's how it looks like.
Why is that not the same representation as phi, psi, psi?
That's inside the 45, but it's just some of them.
It's just a part of it. Okay.
It's just a part of it because...
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
It's within the 45, yes. Definitely. Okay, now what does it mean to have an exactly marginal deformation? Let me remind you. So marginal means that the beta function, or actually beta naught for a certain cupping h, has a vanishing linear term, so the first derivative vanishes, and that's equivalent to saying that the dimension of the operator is 4. The question happens, what happens when you turn this operator on? As h becomes non-zero, the beta function could receive corrections. To be exactly marginal, we require that the beta function, for all the couplings that we change, remains identically zero for finite deformations. Now, what's the trick in n equals 1? What's the miracle there? How does it work? Lynn Strassler explained to us that if we take the so-called NSVZ formula, that the beta functions are, except for the beta naught, are linearly dependent on the gamma functions of the theory, the field strength renormalizations, this relation is exact. So it's enough for us to make sure that all the gamma functions are zero. This will immediately tell us that all the betas are zeros for couplings which have beta naught equals to zero, which are the fields that we pick to start with. So therefore, gamma equals to zero is the number of constraints. And then they simply argue, if the number of couplings is larger than the number of constraints, then you will have some solutions generically. You will have a manifold of conformal theories with dimensions, which is the difference of the two. So let's see what this means in our case. In our case, we have couplings 10 plus 1. Constraints are in the gamma ij, because we can have a two-point function of phi I and phi j, and for non-zero h, there could be a cross term, so it's not just three of them, but it's actually a whole matrix. There could be cross terms also for the gammas, so it's 8 plus 1, I put the trace on the side. And we also should divide by the global group, because any two deformations which are identified by an SU through rotation, I call the same. So I now do the subtraction, and I find that there are two complex exactly marginal parameters in addition to tau. So all in all, there are three complex. So now I want to turn into the supergravity side to start and see. Oh, not yet, sorry. First, I want to be more explicit about how the constraint looks like. If I take these two h's, then it simply take the multiplication of the two h's, so it's 10 times 10 bar of the circuit, and take the h representation out of it, the adjoint, and to be explicitly, that's the formula. So that's the equation one finds from looking explicitly at the gamma functions perturbatively. Note that this looks exactly like a D-term constraint. If the SU3 were not the global symmetry but the gauge symmetry, it would be just a D-term constraint, which together with the division by the action of SU3 describes a holomorphic quotient of this space of couplings, the 10 complex, by the complexified group. So from the filter, I find that MC locally looks like this space divided by this complex holomorphic quotient. Okay, so now I'm going to go to the supergravity if there are no questions.
Okay. So what does that space look like?
This space is two-dimensional. It has some singularity in it, which looks like C2 divided by some finite group. But actually, I will not discuss it, but we discuss it in the paper. If you try to find gauge invariant coordinates on it, you find that it can be described by just two coordinates. So it can be smoothed out in that sense. The complex structure there is smooth. There is no singularity with as far as that is concerned. The same way that C divided by Z2, you can work with Z squared instead of Z, and then you have a good coordinate. So in the same sense here, you can have two good coordinates, but still you could have a singularity in the metric. It could be a convolute singularity in the metric. So we don't have anything to say about the metric there. Okay, good. So we proceed to supergravity. First, I want to argue
why isn't that, if that's the only constraint, mm-hmm. Why isn't that then a global description of the space?
There are two questions here. One is topological, and the second is the metric on the moduli space. So we expect that there is a metric, the same way as in two dimensions, you have this homological metric.
No, but there I know what I mean by metric. Right. I'm looking at an effective action about these
right.
Vectors. Well, what do I mean by a metric on moduli space of conformal footprint?
I think the definition should generalize, but I don't know enough about it to answer it right now. So I expect that there is a general answer to that, but we haven't discussed that. As we will see from the supergravity point of view, this moduli space will just be an ordinary moduli space of vacuum for the supergravity. And there I think we know what we mean, at least there in the supergravity limit, by a metric on the moduli space of vacuum. So it's clear to me that the notion should carry over. Topologically, I'm not sure whether that tells us that topologically it's just this or not. I'm not sure whether you can deduce something about finite deformations going in that direction. If you can tell me otherwise, I'd be very interested. Okay, so I'd like to argue that the supergravity should something like that. I'd like to argue that the supergravity should also have this three complex manifold of conformal deformations. And, well, the reason is that our analysis was carried in weak coupling, but as we go over to strong coupling, I don't expect this dimension to change. It's a manifold that includes in it the line of couplings. So we know already that we can change the coupling and we're still a conformal field theory. So I expect that the whole manifold around it will have the same dimension. And moreover, the operators which I turn on at first order will turn out to be protected operators. So I expect that they are preserved by supergravity. And I'll show you explicitly later that indeed all this manifold is preserved by the supergravity. Okay. Another point has to do with the B field. The supergravity has this SO1,1 or SF2R, if you like, in other languages, symmetry, which allows us to set the complex coupling, at initially at least, to some value. I call it B equals to 0. It's the same as tau equals to I, without any loss of generality. So in the supergravity, it's very clear that the one dimension of B completely decouples from the two other dimensions, which are interesting, and I will mostly talk about the two other complex dimensions. Okay, so now, can we translate the field theory analysis one-to-one, as we usually do to supergravity, and what's the big deal? Well, it's confusing. Why is it confusing? The gamma functions are defined as some two-point functions here, or things phi, but the operators phi themselves don't appear in the supergravity because they're not gauge invariant. We just have some trace. Mm-hmm. I should have had a trace here. Moreover, the gamma functions, as I put here, is not really gauge invariant, SUN gauge invariant. So actually, the whole language of Lee and Strassler is kind of vague on this point. They are using an object which is not really gauge invariant, but is roughly right. So at weak coupling, it doesn't matter very much. I could have made it maybe gauge invariant, and that would change only by a little. But this is somehow unclear. So I will try to replace it later by a more invariant concept. Okay, so translating this Strassler is not straightforward, and expect supergravity to help shed light on this Strassler.
That kind of goes back all the way to Schiffman et al., because they also use the same theorem.
So that's the anesthesia. Okay, so now let's launch on the general theory of nonlinear deformations of some, just some equations of gravity, some partial differential equations. So how do we analyze such deformations? So we analyze them perturbatively. We could analyze two things. We could analyze the equations of motion or the Suzy variation. I told you that I'm interested in the Suzy variation, but let's start discussing first the equations of motion. So we could do it order by order. What does that mean? We expand the fields in orders in some perturbation parameter, expand the equations. How do the equations look at zeroth order, at first order? Well, then we have a bunch of variables. Actually, we take all our fields, say scalar fields on S5, we decompose them into Kaluza-Klein modes, into spherical harmonic modes, same way that Kim Romans Levanov-Weinheisen did. And then each one of them has a mass, and to lowest order we just have this equation, Laplacian on ADS5, plus mi squared of phi equals to zero. And I'm leaving here the possibility that there are some constraints equations as well. Now, if I want to find a solution which is ADS invariant, the Laplacian better vanish, there is no ADS dependence. And you see that at first order, I can turn the field 5 if and only if its mass is 0. That's what we discussed also before. So these will be the marginal deformations in the field theory language. What happens at higher orders? Well, we expand now each field in such a way where this index in parentheses is the order in the expansion and H is my perturbation parameter. And we substitute that in the equations. How will the equations look like? At each order, they will look like the same operator acting on the nth order perturbation equals something that comes from previous orders. So that's the way the equations will look at each order. Now these equations are easily solvable from 1, 0, m, because then this vanishes and you only have to divide by m and you're done. The only problematic modes are exactly the modes that we had before, the zero modes. So at each order, if this side is non-zero for m equals to 0, we have here an impossible equation. So that would be the obstruction that I was talking about. These will be the things that will kill us. Okay, so for a mode which was n equals to 0, if the right-hand side, which comes from the equations of motion, from expanding the equations of motion, is non-zero, that kills that mode. So there are obstructions. For each zero mode, actually, there is one obstruction, possibly more even from the constraints, but at least there are more. There are equal and maybe even more obstructions than zero modes. So here came our first confusion. Before the confusion, I want to mention here the question of uniqueness. You see that for the fields with m equals to 0, if the right-hand side is 0, I can add at higher orders a contribution to phi. No one stops me from that. So in that sense, the solutions are not unique, but that only amounts to a redefinition of H. So this is very familiar, let's say, from perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. So we say that we turn them on only first order, say, the specific coupling, and then we don't turn the same one at higher orders at all. Okay, this will not be important for us for the rest of the day. Okay, now what is the confusion here about the obstruction shooting only once? Well, from the discussion that I showed you now, each of these obstructions, each of these zero modes, seems to give us an obstruction, and it looks like at each order in perturbation theory, I will have to satisfy it. So it seems like I will have infinitely many equations to satisfy for finitely many variables. For instance, I have, 45 plus 105 variables, and then as many equations, but at each order. This is wrong, but I want to explain why, because you were confused about it for a while. So this is what I mean. I want to show you why each obstruction shoots only once. After it kills a solution, it doesn't kill anymore. No, definitely not my intention. Okay, for that it's enough to think for a moment about a simple nonlinear equation, even in two variables. And the same thing will happen there, but then when there we understand exactly what's happening, and that will help us get out of the confusion. So I think, for instance, this equation. So I have two variables, one equation. At linear order, there's nothing, so it's 0 equals to 0, so I have two zero modes. And at higher orders, I will always have one equation, so I can start expanding x and y, and then from the point of view that I said before, it will look like at each order I have to satisfy the equation. But this is actually not true. We know that one equation in two variables has generically one dimension of solutions, right? And the reason we got confused is just because we were looking at it in a perturbative way, so that's somewhat confusing, but the final result should be that the obstruction keeps only one of the solutions, and the dimension of solutions remains one. Let's see in detail how it works. So at second order, this equation, the x cubed disappears, x squared minus y squared, and I have two solutions, x equal to plus minus y. Because this equation is nonlinear, the set of solutions has a singularity at the origin, necessarily. In this case, it is just an intersection singularity, nothing worse than that. But the important thing is that the perturbation expansion around the origin is now ill-defined once I found this singularity. So I should reorganize the perturbation in this language. So the way I reorganize it, I write y equals to x plus something small. Okay, so I I expand around one of the branches, and identically, I could expand around the other branch. And then I find that this first correction looks like this, and I could go on now in perturbation theory, and I would have no more obstructions. And so I would find the exact curve imperturbably moving around the origin. Okay, so that's one confusion out of the way. Okay, all in all, the equations of motion, generically, we have no solutions. Why? Because we saw that for each zero mode, there was an obstruction. However, as always, the situation changes once we look at the Suzy variation equations. And that was a key step, to look at the Suzy variation equations. Why? Symbolically, I write these equations as Suzy variation of a fermion equals some operator acting on a boson. Okay? Now, the zero modes are bosons which are sent to zero. So the zero modes live in the bosonic space. The obstructions, on the other hand, are when we have here something non-zero that has to be equal here to something which is zero. That lives in the fermionic space. So intrinsically, the zero modes and the obstructions live in different spaces, while beforehand they were identified. And that allows for us the possibility that there will be a different number of them. Actually, that's a famous phenomenon, and it has a name. It is called the index of the operator. It's the number of zero modes minus the number of obstructions, and it could very well be different than zero. Let me explain that a little more. Why am I using here the word index? For finite systems of equation, the number of zero modes minus the number of obstructions is nothing but the total number of variables minus the total number of equations. So for finite system of equations, we never worry about this because we simply count the total number of variables, the total number of equations, and we're done. However, with an infinite set of variables like we have here, all these YLMs, we have an infinite number of variables and an infinite number of equations. So you need to know somehow how to take the difference of these two infinite magnitudes, and that's exactly what the index defines for you. It concentrates on some finite subspace, the kernel, which are the zero modes, the co-kernel, which are the obstructions, and it allows for you to find the difference of these two infinite sets in a well-defined way. So this would be my first conclusion, that the right way to think about it is in terms of an index of the supersymmetry variation. This must be the software mechanism that guarantees that once we have a solution, it will exist to all orders. Okay, that was the first question that I was asking, the surviving mechanism. So we see that as long as we have more variables than equations, that's it. We will have a moduli space. Okay. People look back. That's okay. Okay. Now, we didn't quite understand it, though. How everything works, so we decided to go into a long and difficult way of perturbative computations. And I would like now to describe this in some detail, which would be more for the experts in the audience. Yes?
Before you do that, I mean, so yes. Before you got to the supersymmetry variations, the conclusion of the equation of motion discussion was that generically you don't have solutions. But of course, you're looking, you want solutions, right? You're modulating.
There's an apparent contradiction. That's what you asked.
Well, because of course the supersymmetry variation should be giving you solutions.
Right. So that means that the equations of motion are in some sense degenerate. You could have sets of equations where you have the same number of variables and constraints, but they could be degenerate. So it's important to stress that once you find this index, you can find only this, in some sense, the generic dimension of moduli space. You can have examples where you have one equation that kills two variables, for instance, x squared plus y squared, x equals minus 1 for real variables, you have no solution. And the other way around, you could have an equation that has more solutions than it should have. So from the equations of motion, we couldn't conclude that there are any, but once we know about the Suzy variation, then it's clear to us that there were some degeneracies that we didn't know about when to start with. Okay. So we'll try to compute the first terms in H, actually the first and the second of the deformation, and see explicitly how does it look like on S5. So our equations will be the Suzy variation equations, which I wrote in the beginning. Our variables, or our ansatz, would be an SO4,2 symmetric ansatz. And we're going to work in what we call the 4/6 split, meaning that we split four coordinates of R4 and one radial coordinate we take together and add it to the sphere to think about it as an R6, okay? This is common in RG flows in ADMs discussions. Here, one could consider also a 5-5 split where you put aside the ADS and the S5 aside. And in this case, because we don't want to touch the ADS, that means that would have made sense, but we prefer to stay with this, partly because of agreement with the literature, and partly because we want to know what happens to the nodes which are not marginal. Then we'll like to ask, are they marginally irrelevant, as we see later, or something else? Well, actually, we could have seen it already from the perturbative formula that I wrote for the gamma function. So at zero of order, the way I wrote this metric, this is just flip R6. I have here the 1 over R squared, which I have made for the sphere. And here I have an arbitrary warp factor, which still preserves the ADS isometries. The phi from field strength is uniquely determined by self-duality and closeness up to an overall constant F5. I wrote here something more explicit. It's not very important. And as we reviewed before, the complex scalar could be anything, the 3 form could be anything in the directions of the 5 sphere. And we set B equals to 0 using SR2R, we discussed. And we must also have an ansatz for the Killing spinner, and here it's slightly important. First, I factor out an R to the half out of it and call it chi to take away the radial dependence. And I also put in an arbitrary choice of rho, the rho factor. But the important thing is that chi, the spinner, decomposes into 2 parts. One part is proportional to some 4-dimensional spinner zeta of a certain chirality, and then the times a 6-dimensional spinner, which I call chi even, and then the other part is proportional to its complex conjugate, which is of the opposite chirality in 4 dimensions, and then also chi has to be of an opposite chirality in 6 dimensions, because chi in type 2b is chiral, so the chiralities are coupled, the 4-dimensional and 6-dimensional chiralities are coupled. The zeroth order solution is just ADS 5 plus S5, that's what we start with, and then we plug the ansatz into the equations, and we get this set of equations. So it's all it is, it's a set of equations on S5. I should explain why I have here 2 equations for psi, except the gravitino instead of 1. When the gravitino has an index, it could either be in the S5 direction, in which case I have this equation that includes a derivative of chi, or I could take psi in the directions of the R4, and then all of them are the same. So actually I can omit the index, then I get this equation, and this is again the Dilatino. So we see what are the equations, we see what are the variables, they are rho, the metric which hides in the covariant derivative, the 3 form, and P, which is the derivative of B. And of course we should solve at the same time for chi also. Now the first order, before the first order, actually we have here a U and R symmetry that we want to preserve. That means essentially that we're fibering the S5 over U1 to get the CP2. So we should actually geometrically think about this set of equations as a set of equations on CP2, if we like. Now there's a whole bunch of group theory that could be done here, and we tried that, but I will be very explicit, I will not be using that. Could use the fact that S5 and CP2 could be written as symmetric spaces, and then the harmonic analysis, all the modes on them can be described in terms of group representations. And we found a very useful tool for that, a software package called MI, but I will not be using that.
What does the package do?
It can do wonderful things with groups. It can give you a tensor product. It can give you branching, so you want to branch it from SO6 to SU3 cross U1. Any representation, it will give you the answer immediately. So instead of using tables or some things that are not available in tables, it does that very nicely. Okay, so first thing, after the zeroth order equation, we should do the linearization. And that tells us what is the spectrum of fields or operators. And again, I will show you the figure of the whole, of this whole spectrum. Okay. So we have these six branches. As we said, the 10 that we're turning on at first order will be in this 45 over here, and then at next order will be turning fields, I think, anywhere here, something like this. So one could analyze it in a group theoretic way. But that's only limited. Finally, you have to solve the equations, I believe. Okay. Actually, the linearized equation get doubled because we have both the zeta and the zeta star, which were two spinners of opposite chiralities, four dimensions. We get one set of equations for zetas and one set of equations for zeta star. Mm-hmm. And actually, H turns out to be odd under some Z2. Actually, it's the minus one within SL2Z. So that tells us the important outcome of that is that at all orders, we're only allowed to turn on G, the three-form field strength. And that's what we're going to do here, at linear order. And only chi odd. While at even orders, we are only allowed to turn on the other fields, the metric on S5, the B field, the Wolf factor, and chi even. So there is a certain grading in the problem, which simplifies it significantly. Yes, maybe this is a good point to look at. Okay, so I wrote here explicitly the equations at linear order, so you see that only G appears here at the odd orders, and if we linearize the even part, then we see that we get here rho, B, omega, the spin connection is related to the metric. And we also need to impose a flux quantization constraint on this F5, which was the overall constant on the field strength 5-4 field strength. Okay. Now, in principle, one would like to solve this order by order. It becomes very difficult, as you will see in a moment, and we use Mathematica to confirm our computations or to check them. You have to teach it how to use forms and stuff. The first order, luckily, was done for us by Grania and Pochinski, and that's already surprisingly difficult.
Not Mathematica.
But it's pretty difficult to write, right? You'd expect it just proportional to H. But H comes here in all kinds of different forms, the way you write it. So it's already, unfortunately, it looks complicated. So H was our deformation parameter. And then we have here DZs. So I introduced context coordinates on R6, Z and Z bars. And Z with lower index are actually Z bars. Okay, so that's the convention here. And there's also a chi1 that we get here that is proportional to G and has this explicit expression. Now, this is an interesting problem, actually, the fact that we're turning on here the three-form field strength, because why not just deform the metric? Well, if we had the deformations of S5, which keep it Einstein, namely that it's still a solution of the equations of motion with a positive cosmological constant, that would be a solution for type 2b, right? Any deformation of S5, just the metric, which would remain Einstein, that would be a solution. However, mathematicians know that S5 doesn't have Einstein deformations. It's Einstein rigid. Moreover, until the 80s, they didn't have examples at all of positive Einstein deformations. Now there are known many examples. So we have to turn on something other than the metric. So that's my point. Positive. Positive means that the cosmological constant is positive. So for negative, spaces with negative cosmological constant, you could easily, these are all kinds of complex spaces and you can form the complex structure and stuff like this. So they had easy examples of how to do that in four dimensions. But for the positive ones, it seemed it was more difficult, but it turned out there wasn't any intrinsic problem. Just there are examples that were harder to find.
But not on
S5. Not on S5. S5 is
so
rigid.
Squash 7 spheres. Been known for a while.
I don't know if you can deform that. Do you know if you can deform that? Continuously. All my deformations here are continuous. I think S7, at least around S7, will have the same property, that there will be no metric continuous deformations. You will have to turn on the field strength there also. Yeah, but that's a good question. Okay, so the first order we already knew. Now let's go to the second order. Actually, the second order was also done by Rainer and Pochesky, right? That's for the complex axiom and Dilaton. But the rest of the fields were not. So for that, you simply go to the equations that I showed before, the linearized odd equations, okay? And you take, for instance, this would be the equation for rho, only the repeat dot 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 is coming from first order. So you have to substitute them and then solve for rho. So that's what we do. So here is a solution, the solution for rho. Notice that it looks exactly like the scalar potential in field theory. It's the derivative H was like the superpotential. H sub I, or I went through too fast over there. So usually we had H I J K. And then when I have fewer indices is when I contract H with the Z's. Let's see, why wasn't it here? Oh, here. Okay, so I define H I J like so and H I like so. So by contractions with the Z. So these are the complex coordinates on R6. So I have Z123 and Z bar 123. So you see that each one of these is HZZ or H55 in field theory language. And then this looks exactly like the gradient of W absolute value squared. So it looks, for some reason, we don't have an interpretation for this right now. Okay, the interesting part happens with the metric. And that's where the obstruction will hit us. And that's also the complicated part, more complicated part. So I write here explicitly the equation for the metric. I have here the odd part of the spinner. And I have here the deformation in the metric. So S is defined as the small deformation in the metric on R6. I want it to be a special thing. I want S to be special in the sense that it will deform only the S5, but will keep the R direction. So it will keep the R direction orthogonal and separate from the S5. That will be important for us. So S is second rank symmetric in a real tensor. And we get this equation. We substitute in the row that we already know. And we need to know what is this B epsilon, which is this thing. So B sub M and B upper M are my notations for BM and BM bar. So I raise and lower indices with a metric which is 1 in this basis. Okay, so that equation has two types of terms. It has terms which are gamma ij times the zeroth order spinner, which is kind of the basis of this Fock space of spinners. And it will have terms proportional to just a chi 0. So here is a term proportional to chi 0 is a term proportional to two lowering operators on chi 0, to raising, depends how you want to think about it. So the gamma ij ones can be solved by this, and the important point is that you can add here an arbitrary function that we call k, and that will still be working. To see that, we go back to the equations, we see that the equations have in them an anti-symmetric derivative because of the spin connection here. So if S itself is a derivative of K and we take another derivative and anti-symmetrize, this part vanishes. So we're still free to add this function K. This function K will have the obstruction in it. The chi 0 term has two equations, one for a chi 2, which is proportional to chi naught by this factor. So that's one part of the equation. And the other part is K. And on the right-hand side, there is some source. And from that, we see that the solution after we subtract these two equations is that the Laplacian of K is some explicit expression. Chi 2 happens to be 0 in this convention. Now the question is, can we solve this equation? Laplacian of K equals to something, to a source term. And it will turn out, we can solve it almost. So here is the equation, the fashion of k equals to some function. F is a homogeneous function of degree 2, by which I mean that as you go in the r direction, it goes like r squared. Oh, I'm sorry, f is of degree 0 and k is of degree 2. I should have written it the other way around, right? And then when I apply the Laplacian, both sides are of degree 0. So in order to solve it, you can decompose into spherical harmonics, like this, both k and the solution. And you apply the Laplacian, so you get the irregular part and the angular part, which in six dimensions is L times L plus 4. And then because of the spatial, because k goes like r squared, this part gives us 12, so we get this equation. And we see that for L equals to 2, exactly for L equals to 2, the left-hand side vanishes. So for L equals to 2, the left-hand side vanishes, while the right-hand side, the L equals 2 mode on the right-hand side, need not vanish. That's our obstruction. So L equal to 2 is our obstruction. If the right-hand side is non-zero, that kills the solution. Let's see if it's indeed what we expect from field theory. Well, L equals 2, when you write it explicitly, what we mean is just two Z's, and it, indeed it's exactly proportional to this A, to this L joint of the H's. Okay, so it works nicely with what we expect from a field theory. Well, we could find a solution, actually, to this case if we allow a logarithmic dependence. So if we allow k not only to be constant in the r direction, but to have a logarithm, we'll be generating here a logarithm, the way we expect, actually, from a marginal deformation, which is not exactly marginal. It generates logs. But let's look, how does this log solution look like? So it looks like, well, it looks like it violates the ADS isometry because it's R-dependent, and to be ADS symmetric, it should not depend on R, but this violation can be compensated by a diffeomorphism, which is not exactly a rotation of the sphere, but it's a complex SU3 rotation, namely like so. So if I had an I here, that would have been a small rotation of the sphere. But without the I, it's more like I'm making it into, instead of a sphere, I'm giving it some bumps. So that's the diffeo that I have to use it. So it's a complexified SU3 in that sense. It looks like ripples on S5. So this diffeo is important because it doesn't vanish as R goes to infinity. So the conformal symmetry is still ruined, okay? It's subtle here. Mm-hmm. You would think that if it's diffeomorphic to a solution which is which preserves the ABS, it's good. But the diffeo itself doesn't vanish as R goes to infinity. So the diffeo itself is not good enough for us. Mm-hmm. And the appearance of a complex gauge transformation is exactly what we expect from a D term. So maybe here I should say that right now we agree that what we have here is a complex gauge transformation, but there is some disagreement whether this is a D term. I claim that complex gauge transformation, we know that's a D term.
So why is complex gauge transformation what we expect from a D term?
From the gauge theory we saw, we don't know this thing in general, but we saw explicitly that when we wrote down the equation, it looked like a D-term equation for these couplings in H. So we computed the gamma functions, and I can, you want to see the
function? I remember that.
So, and we saw that explicitly it was in the adjoint, like we expect from a D-term, so that's all. It just looked like a D-term.
I mean, the log is this is what you get when the obstruction is non-vanishing, is that right?
Right, yeah, right.
So even when the obstruction is non-vanishing, you say...
So when the obstruction is non-vanishing, we have to use this complexified gauge transformation. And here, well, I may not be 100% clear, but I think we have a number of pieces of evidence that show us that what we have here is a D-term. And I think I'm listing them now, yes. So let me list what are the reasons I suspect that the correct concept for the obstruction is a D-term rather than gamma functions, okay? Mm-hmm. So first, the explicit equation in the field theory looked like this, which is exactly the way a D-term equation looks like, or the holomorphic quotient looks like. Actually, from the field theory point of view, we expect M sub C to be complex manifold. We know that in the old language, you can think of couplings as being part of background chiral fields. And in that language, it's clear that the coupling should live in a complex space. So it's natural to have B terms in order to guarantee that the resulting space is also complex. So you start with some couplings, you want to divide them and stay with the complex space. So it has to be a B term. Moreover, like the B term, our obstruction is an ABS scalar, and it's in the same representation in the adjoint of SU3. Moreover, suppose we think about it from the point of view of 5D n equals 1 supergravity, but not from the point of view of the completely truncated theory that is known, rather from the point of view of the supergravity, which has an additional matter, say the certain modes of the free form and other modes. We can add that to the supergravity in addition to the truncated version. Then such general supergravity with general couplings is known to have a scalar potential which has any terms that look like a D term. It's hard to decipher those papers usually, but they look like D terms. Okay, so those are the reasons why I think that the right language to think of the obstruction in supergravity and therefore also in field theory is as a D term for the global group. These are the obstructions. Okay, I'm almost at the end. I see that I have a minute, so I will discuss here. This is somewhat of a side result, but maybe one of you will have a comment on that. Consider the ones which are not exactly marginal. Both from the field theory and supergravity point of view, we can see that they're marginally irrelevant. We may ask, what is the value of the beta function? We can compute it both at weak coupling from field theory and at strong coupling from the supergravity. And we have here a preliminary result, which we did not test yet, which says that it's the same. So it both, you could imagine that there will be some function of the coupling in front of it. So it has to look like, as I remarked in the beginning, the beta function has to look like the gamma, or maybe I should call it now D, times H. So D would be quadratic in H, and times H. But maybe there could be here a function of G also in front. So it seems like we have here some sort of a non-renormalization theorem, and we don't know whether that's a new one or not. Okay, so let's summarize now. Well, we were out to understand the supergravity side of exactly conformal deformations, and that shed some light on the field theory as well. We now understand that the mechanism that guarantees the existence of this solution is the fact that the supersymmetry has some index. The obstruction is a D-term, both in supergravity and in the field theory. We believe we should replace the words gamma functions, which happen to be gamma ij bar, so they're in the 8 also. We should think about it as a D-term rather. So we're not claiming that they were wrong, but we're claiming there's a more precise language to say it. We can say something locally.
That removes the problem with gating variables.
Right. Because then you don't have this fun.
I'm still understanding what's the isomorphism between a gamma function.
What's the
isomorphism between a gamma function and a D-term? I mean, I see, see the other part of the equation, but I'm confused by, can I somehow restate the Strassler or SVZ now generally in this language?
That's my claim. However, I cannot tell you anything about it. My talk today is about the supergravity side. Okay. Let's say that the field theory side is work in progress. Okay, so I cannot be precise about that, but I expect that exactly should be done. Okay, we know something locally about this space, which I described a little beforehand. It's the 10 complex divided by this group. It's equivalent to C2 divided by some finite group. And moreover, we were very explicit and we determined the deformation completely, the Wall factor, the spinner, the metric, up to second order, and some open questions remain, some of them already mentioned. So, first question, maybe it would be nice to make the whole analysis more neat, is to show that there are no other obstructions. We showed right now that there was one obstruction, maybe there are more. I didn't show that there are no others. So, from the field theory, we expect that there are no others, but we didn't show that yet. Okay, we already mentioned that there are some other cases, such as ABS form of S7 and other cases, which are in progress, and to show that this picture hangs in the field theory, in the D-term and the index. Well, we're used to an index at least in two dimensions, we're used that an index tells the number of conformal deformations. I don't think that it's well known that it works also in four in such a way. Mm-hmm. So that's in progress. Mm-hmm. The second question, very interesting, is about the geometry that we have here. So when we have a Calabi-Yau compactification, we know that the manifold has to be complex, it has to be Kähler. We know something about the geometry there of the manifold itself. I'm not talking about MC, rather about the deformed S5. Here, I don't know, there are some results about manifolds with fluxes, but I don't think, I don't know what they tell us in this case. Mm-hmm. So Strominger many years ago discussed compactifications with torsion. There he turned on the three form, but only the NS part of it. There we found that there was a complex structure, but no Kähler geometry there. The Kähler was violated proportionally to the existence of the torsion. And the Beckers studies that comes in with the fluxes, and also here. So that's one set of interesting.
I think Range identifies different special case, and the general perturbation is in neither special category, right. Which is, and is much messier therefore.
Right, you had case ending case Becker, right?
Right, right.
So, and this case is in between, okay. So no, you need C. Okay, so another question, which is somewhat puzzling, is this perturbative expansion that we're carrying in the supergravity, what happened in second order, what happened in third order, all of this doesn't seem to have a mirror in the field theory. Field theory, just turn an operator and that's it. You don't turn another one at second order and so on. While in the supergravity, you keep adding pieces all the time. So it's not clear to us what does it mean, what all, because from the conservation of computations, if a computation is done on the supergravity side, should have a meaning also. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's just, maybe we're just computing the dictionary. But maybe we are computing something, how some correlation functions are changing on the field theory. So I'd be happy to discuss that later if anyone understands that. There is the issue of the manifolds of conformal theories that I discussed before. So from this point of view, we actually should ask ourselves, what is the moduli space of vacuum of Yates supergravities? We don't know much about it. So again, what is it, the geometry? Is it Kähler? Is it complex? Is it compact? Is there any topology? All the questions that I mentioned already. I think it would be very interesting to study both in this theory and in any other field theory, conformal field theory in four dimensions. There's an interesting effect that happens here, which is a Suzy enhancement on the moduli space. Here I mean moduli space M sub C. So at the origin, we have N equals 4, or in terms of supergravity, 32 supercharges. The moment we go off the origin, we go into 8 supercharges. This phenomenon cannot happen for compactifications without a cosmological constant, or for perturbative string theory. Mm-hmm. Namely, when you do a Calabi-Yau or K3 thing, mm-hmm. and you move on the moduli space, the amount of supersymmetry stays fixed. It cannot suddenly be enhanced. And there are theorems to that effect by Banks and Dixon from the worksheet point of view, and by Diamond Cyber, just relying on a low energy gravity, namely the fact that the cosmological constant is zero. So here is an interesting example for the opposite. Maybe that's related to the other stuff, maybe not. Finally, from a mathematical point of view, I mentioned that already, deformations of positive Einstein manifolds. This is an example of how, by relaxing what we call an Einstein deformation, we find deformations where previously it was believed there were none. So that could find applications in mathematics, I don't know, but at least that's a possibility. So I think that concludes the open questions, and I would like to, since this year I'm leaving from the Institute and I'm going to Jerusalem next year for a position, I wanted to invite anyone who is interested next year to come to Jerusalem. Thank you.